So what I'm going to talk about, according to the title, is Hospitals Before the NHS, Finance, Specialisation and Integration. And I've picked out these three themes because I think these are three of the areas in which the historiography of the pre-NHS period, and particularly of the second half of the 1930s, has tended to focus around these aspects, and around particularly the idea that that the old system was in financial difficulties, if not indeed bankrupt, that the lack of coordination and cooperation caused significant problems for the system, and that, and thirdly, that there was a break on specialisation, which was caused by this, particularly by both the lack of finance and the lack of coordination. And my bogeyman is Charles Webster, and I've sort of attribute all kinds of things to him, which are probably entirely untrue. But I do have one or two quotes, particularly in relation to coordination, where in one of his political history of the NHS, he describes the interwar period under the heading Chaos and Depression, and subsequently, in, or previously, in his history of the NHS. He was, when talking about coordination of voluntary hospitals, he says, you know, essentially there were the worst disjunction of the system was between the municipal and voluntary hospital sectors, that there have been continual efforts to get them to talk to each other, but these have been consistently ignored. There were one or two cases of good practice, Liverpool, Oxford. But on the whole, he says, local authorities expanded their hospital services without reference to their voluntary neighbours or even in a spirit of competition or emulation. And in similar vein, Abel Smith, a little earlier, had said there had been attempts to coordinate, but covered only a small part of the country. And where there was no coordinating body, the voluntary hospitals worked in rivalry with one another. So in that case, they're both in rivalry with another. And over the majority of the country, there was no coordination whatsoever. So in general, you get the sense in which the traditional history from those two key texts, Webster and Abel Smith, talk about a failure of development. And these have tended to feed in to work on the subsequently on the NHS. For example, Rodney Lowe describes the period as chaotic and highly inefficient. There are references to the fact that there are problems with the development of services like cancer. Webster points to a failure of cancer services to meet, and most people aren't able to access those. And you see in the standard works a kind of a bit of a echoing, particularly of Webster's views down to. And these, I think, is quite important because, particularly with those and with the standard works on the interwar period, things like Pew or Keith Laybourne, these are the things which then make it into general political history teaching. These are the things which become the currency of knowledge of the average student and the average kind of knowledgeable person about these things. And that's why I think it's quite important that a lot of the revisionism that's taken place has not yet made its way to that kind of level of textbooks. And there's also, in general, there's this focus on universalism and expectation that the health system needed to be universal, as in everybody acquiring the same access to this and the same rights and the same access. And that difference was seen as a problem in this. Part of that chaos was the element of difference. Many of these sort of, much of the history of the national level of development of the NHS has been based on a range of sources, which are mostly developed at a national level. So I've got a couple of Ministry of Health collections there. The first one, MH66, has not yet been extensively exploited. And this is a series of surveys undertaken by the Ministry of Health in the early 1930s into municipal hospital provision, but with some references to the voluntary sector and with references to developing or not developing coordination. And MH58 is a kind of ragbag of stuff they seem to have collected in a rather random way about hospital development in the interwar period. And it has material in there on Sheffield and on Oxford and on the South West, some of which is commissioned, some of which is material they've simply acquired. Sheffield send them information about themselves, which they ignore. So those sort of collections of materials have been quite important in terms of the way historians have developed it. The Nuffield surveys of 1945, much, much more important, massive material. But I think, again, the tendency has been to look more at the generality of these works rather than the specifics of them. There's been quite a lot of confidence in the Labour Party and what they say on things, and Labour Party people's views are held more highly, I think, often, than those of Conservatives or defenders of the voluntary sector. And then these feed into parliamentary debates in which ideological positions are often taken and taken as the position of the two sides. So that, if you like, the politics of it become very significant. The one kind of exception, one of the things I missed off there is the Sankey Commission of the late 1930s, which the voluntary hospitals do put together, and the PEP, independent report on health services. Sorry, but there is a tendency to, I would feel that there is a tendency to put the PEP report above the Sankey Commission in terms of its authority. And it's because it's seen as being independent if developed by a centrist to left think tank. And a lot of these sources tend to focus on the negative. You know, they don't say often, or if they do see it, like I mentioned earlier, you know, if you do see good practice, this is quickly dismissed in preference for a focus on the weak. Now, they have, of course, you know, most of those works are 20-plus years old, and there has been extensive debate and challenges to this over the last 20-odd years. Around finance, obviously, the work that Martin's done with John Mearn, with Martin Powell, and on his own has been really important. That by Steve Cherry, and more recently by George Gosling down on Bristol, and on Nick Hayes on the Midlands. All of these have kind of developed a fairly extensive, much more nuanced understanding of the situation financially between the wars, and particularly by avoiding looking just at 1921 and 1938, which were the two disastrous years because of heavy inflation. But by looking at the long-term trends, you see a much more optimistic view, particularly for the non-metropolitan hospitals, for the provincial hospitals. And they've kind of come to the current position, I think, although there's still debate around this, that the mutualist contributory schemes, that the voluntary hospitals were to some extent staved by the mutual contributory schemes, depending on your point of view, whether they're mutual or contributory insurance schemes. And that Sheffield is often held up as the model, indeed, for the ideal scheme, which I'll talk about a bit later on. So, in general, the voluntary hospitals are seen as, to some extent, being saved by this, having struggled in the early 20s with a loss of income from their traditional sources. There's also been some discussion of coordination, possibly less than you might hope for, but the biggest and most significant piece, which actually really looks like coordination in a round way, would be that by John Pickstone on the Northwest. John Mearn's stuff on the Northeast is more side by side than a kind of looking at the way in which they work together. And the stuff on London by Ribbit is obviously very good, but I tend to discount London when I'm talking about the provinces because it's so very different. But there is some discussion of coordination, but we could certainly look for more on that. Similarly, we could look for more on specialist services, particularly in the context of coordination. I mean, there has been work by Timmerman and Cantor on cancer, on Kuta, by Kuta on orthopedics. That's kind of accident orthopedics rather than traditional lumbar TB type stuff. And text addressing individual hospitals like the Christie, you know, have developed some understanding of specialist services. But we, again, we're not really kind of pushing too much. Pickstone possibly is one of the few where you see some element of that working within a coordinated system. And lastly, I believe these kind of challenges is the recent work on the municipal services. Started off by John Welshman's survey of Leicester, which is now well over 10 years old, and more recently by the work of Stuart Powell, Levine and Taylor, which was a big project bringing together an extensive survey of MH66 plus four case studies, which looked at four medium-sized towns, although I would say that they are very similar medium-sized towns. I think the one weakness of the case study element is actually the three towns which they choose, three of the four towns, West Hartlepool, Barnsley and Newport, are actually very similar in terms of their social makeup. And it would have been quite interesting to see somewhere, you know, like a Lancashire cotton town or some or somewhere in the Midlands. And Eastbourne, therefore, looks like a bit of an outlier because it's contrasted against these three very heavy industrial towns. But they have brought a whole range of kind of new perspectives because they have, to a great extent, given us the first true kind of picture of what local services at municipal level might look like. So, just briefly, to talk about these, what we might see as a problem with this. To sum up, I think the national evidence by its very nature is national is patchy, beyond some of the aggregated data, things that Martin's done, or some of the stuff which John Stewart and his colleagues have done on aggregated data. In terms of actual picture of operations of systems, it's a bit patchy. Partial by that, I mean it's partial both in terms of, I think really I mean it's partial in terms of the fact that a lot of it has been produced for a specific reason, and often that specific reason is to critique the existing system. And then I think a lot of the material which we've used in the past is objectively, you know, obviously political, and particularly in relation to the Labour Party's views on this. So there are some kind of weaknesses in the national picture that obviously, you know, it creates national norms which are not necessarily easy to any place to fit to. And I suppose I would say this, wouldn't I, but therefore there is an importance of a local or regional approach to understand what is actually happening on the ground. And I particularly think local economic and social conditions are very significant in determining the shape of services which are produced in any given place. Not just in terms of the resources that may be available to that place, but also to the importance they attach to certain services over other services for objective local reasons, which are to do with local needs and local cultures. And I'll talk about that a bit more in my case studies. And I think also, the other thing which the locality can bring is a richer understanding of development from the ground upwards through the sources like annual reports, sources that contrast what's being said by the local authorities with what's being done by the voluntary hospital sector, evidence of interactions between these two groups or lack of them, and local sources which you can actually develop, see the development of services over time, what the barriers are, what the strengths are, what are the things which are pushing us forward or not. So the questions which from this I kind of want to pose loosely in the rest of the paper: how financially robust will hospitals be between the wars? I'm not necessarily going to talk about that in any great sense. This has been one of the key questions of the last 20 years. and I'm not really going to review that, but I'm going to look at the systems that were developed to meet needs for day-to-day costs, for capital projects, and for the local state. I'm also interested in how special services developed, the influence of local needs and regional services, and I'm interested in how cooperation developed, how and why, and if indeed if it did or if it didn't. And also, I think I might add to this, whether it was a linear process. And you'll see that, why I say that in a minute. Excuse me. So, this is going to be a case study, and it's going to be a case study based on two cities in Yorkshire. Or Yorkshire, as we like to say in Yorkshire. Two cities of comparable size, Leeds and Sheffield, about 500,000 population by the end of the 1930s. Leeds had grown quicker than Sheffield and slowed down sooner. Sheffield had still been great right up until the Edwardian period and then slowed just after the First World War. They had a very different... there's a tendency to think that all cities in the north are much the same, and that they, and particularly two cities that are only 40 miles apart, they must be very much the same. But in fact, Leeds and Sheffield are very different. Leeds has a diverse economic structure. It is much more of a commercial city. It has a clothing, men's ready-made clothing sector is the biggest, most dynamic part of its economy in the 1920s and 30s. Still has elements of textiles from its old Industrial Revolution era, has engineering, which is based on that as well. And it's a commercial centre. It's not a big commercial centre, but it is, because of its physical and geographical location at the centre of West Yorkshire, it is the centre of the West Yorkshire, the West Riding textile industry. And as a result, it benefits in various ways. Sheffield, on the other hand, is a metalworking town. It's a town which has both light and heavy metalworking industries. So light industries include the making of cutlery, handcrafting of expensive metals, particularly the new kinds of metals like high tungsten steel and things like that, which were at the cutting edge, of Britain's kind of late industrial revolution in metals. And just a little aside, the guy who invented tungsten steel did it in a cellar of his house. He kind of had a little lab downstairs under his house where he invented tungsten steel. So the good old British way of, you know, let's do it. All this German university labs, let's do it under our house. But it's a very heavy manufacturing munitions during the First World War, big part of the development, large-scale industrial sectors. And this obviously has an impact on social structures. Leeds predominantly has a much larger middle class and a much more diverse, broad middle class than Sheffield. It has, it's not just thanks to Bob Morris we know this, but you know, it does have a proper middle class, which is commercial, industrial, bourgeois. It has large numbers of kind of wealthy women and various other groups within it. It also, as a town, has large numbers of women workers in the workforce. In fact, in the interwar period, the most dynamic parts of the economy, the ready-made clothing sector, is the one which employs predominantly women. And so there are significant numbers of women workers. In fact, there are more jobs than workers for women's jobs in the 1930s, and they have to start importing women workers from outside. And Sheffield is simply the opposite. I mean, it does have, on paper, the same size middle class, but it clearly doesn't. They're a much smaller elite, far fewer commercial jobs, far less diversity in its bourgeoisie. And it's also a predominantly male town. Heavy engineering producers work mostly for men, and this is an overwhelmingly masculine workforce. As a result. And the third kind of headline is around politics, where Leeds, is this really interesting, is probably the most contested municipal authority in Britain, or certainly in England, between the wars. It switches between Conservative and Labour. The Liberals are wiped out. It becomes a straight two-party contest in which both parties capture control at different key moments. The Labour Party is ideological. It is not based on union power because the unions are weak, and there are a prominent role for women in the politics of Leeds, to the extent that the hospital, the health, and the infant and child welfare committees in the mid-1930s all have a majority of women councillors, plus the co-opted members as well. In the case of the infant and child welfare committee, something like 11 of the 14 members are women, although interestingly the chair is not. But a woman does chair the hospital committee. So there are women in very, very important positions. Whether it's Labour or the Conservatives are in control, women have a significant role to play in determining politics, health politics. Sheffield Labour take control in 1926, and with the exception of a one-year period when they get chucked out in 1932, they dominate the council for the entire interwar period. Big unions, masculine workforce, corporatist Labour approach to politics. The council only starts to move to the left at the end of the 1930s, at the same point at which left-wing ideas begin to permeate the trade union movement. But up until that point, it had been very much a union-dominated, traditional Labourist party. Just a brief, possibly totally unhelpful little picture there of who the hospitals are. There are in Leeds five voluntary hospitals of various sizes, three poor law municipal hospitals, and two other municipal hospitals. The key characteristic of Leeds hospital provision is, although there are a large number of institutions, there are three very big ones. The General Infirmary has 600 beds and is one of the largest provincial general infirmaries in the country. St. James's Poor Law Municipal Hospital has 1,300 beds, again making it one of the largest hospitals in the country. And the Seacroft Infectious Diseases has 400 beds and again is a vast institution by standards. So heavy concentration in single institutions across the three parts of the healthcare sector. In Sheffield, there's much more diversity. There is a Royal Hospital and the Royal Infirmary are both about the same size, 200, 250 beds, rising in size over the period. There is also a Children's Hospital and a hospital for women. So all of the voluntary sector is quite dispersed there. There are also two fairly large poor law hospitals, deriving from the fact that Sheffield had been divided into two fairly large poor law unions. And then there is a significant infectious disease. And Sheffield is obsessed with TB. The medical officers of health in Sheffield are obsessed with TB, to the extent that they do strange things like put virtually every small boy into a TB institution and then say, look, we've got the highest levels of TB. And they go, well, it's because they're not right, they're not TB. Yes, they are, they're fine. So they do lots of TB. They also have a traditional orthopaedic hospital for lumbar TB and things like that, scoliosis. If you're not up to speed with this, between the wars, hospital is, as become apparent here, divided between a voluntary hospital sector paid for entirely or almost entirely out of contributions from the public given voluntarily, either through subscriptions or donations or through contributory schemes, as we'll see in a minute. And then you have, up until 1929, a poor law sector, which is the old Board of Guardians provided. It provides a level of general health care, but for certain sectors of society. And then the municipal authorities, up until 1929, are predominantly concerned with infectious disease and some places maternity care, and usually children, but not always. And then 1929, there's an act which kind of tries to unify the municipal and the poor law, and in Leeds they hold out the unification. It doesn't take place until 1934. But after that, broadly speaking, the whole of the bottom half is run by the council, and the top half is run by voluntary organisations. And in terms of beds, you would probably say that in terms of general beds, they are split fairly evenly between the two sectors in these two cities. And this is what I like, often known as my hospital porn. Gratuitous photographs of hospitals. And there's Leeds Infirmary, and then its wing that was built in 1940. I will actually talk about that a little bit later. Jessop Hospital for Women in Sheffield, Leeds Public Dispensary, Leeds Royal Infirmary in Sheffield. You get this sort of sense in here. This is St. James Hospital, the one with 1,300 beds. This is massive. This is now a star of stage screen and television. You know, it's Jimmy's as seen on television. And the Leeds General Infirmary is the one, is it the midwife one, or one born every minute? Is that St. James, or is that... Anyway. So yes, I don't quite know why Leeds is called the market and television live action hospital stuff, but St. James is one of those. And then a kind of sanatorium and a couple of poor law hospitals on the edge there. There is a bit of a tendency that you have to take photographs of poor law hospitals from this kind of angle. You know, you've got to imply that they are somehow demonic. If you saw the thing that you weren't in the one about hospitals, where you were in the other one, but you were in the first one, weren't you, in the TV show? Yes. In the second one, every time they showed a poor law hospital, they kind of went dun dun nah. So there's a kind of sense of this demonic air to them. Although St. James's looks quite just very big there. So that's the kind of background. You've got two quite different sectors there. You've got quite different distributions. We've got one where most of the beds are concentrated in three institutions. And then in Sheffield, you've got a much more diverse range of hospital providers and institutions. So I need to kind of get going, speed up a bit. But we talk about the first of these three issues is finance. And I think how I would describe the difference between Leeds and Sheffield in the way in which they deal with the financial issues is one between corporate response versus diversity. In Sheffield, you have a corporate response, which is the penny in the pound scheme. It's set up in 1921, 22. It's a contributory scheme run by a central organisation called the Hospitals Council. It collects contributions of a penny in the pound of earnings from workers through their employers, which are then collected in a central pot and distributed to the different hospitals on the basis largely of their amount of work undertaken. The big feature of the penny in the pound scheme, there's quite a lot of these, but the two key elements, one is the penny in the pound, which means that the amount that is collected will rise as wages recover in the 1930s, and that's quite an important element because it means they're capable of earning, of bringing in more money. It also means that at some point, a lot of their contributors reach the boundary of what is regarded as being the hospital class. And that happens towards the end of the 30s. The second element, which is really crucial, is the employer contribution. And I believe I am right in saying is that Sheffield has the largest employer contribution. They have effectively a 25% top-up from employers. So one penny for every three pennies contributed by workers. And this operates from the very beginning, and it's earning around, I've calculated, it's bringing in £50,000 from employers by the end of the 30s, which is a very, very significant contribution. It does suffer, and Sheffield in general suffers, during the unemployment of the 20s, long-term low levels of employment in the 20s, very seriously affected by the Depression of 29 to 32. And in that, you see that traditional fundraising is really weakened. There is an attempt in 1932 to run an appeal for the Royal Hospital for its centenary, and it collapses. It makes virtually no cash at all. £20,000 instead of £100,000 is all they're able to raise. But what it does show is that the corporate mentality is beginning to kick in, because it also receives promises from a rich philanthropist who gives them a house for a new nursing home and pays for its doing up. But more importantly, it gets £25,000 for a new block from the miners' welfare. And so this, in Sheffield, the sort of individual handing over their shilling or whatever is becoming much less significant. But large-scale organisations are entering into the fray. And this becomes very much more obvious at the end of the 1930s when they start a fundraising campaign to unite the two hospitals. The two voluntary hospitals are united in 1938 under a single name, United Hospital, and they, in the process of raising £1 million for this to build a new hospital when the war breaks out. And that uses the penny in the pound scheme, basically, that they identify employers, employees, and ordinary givers as the three places where they will earn money for this, and they set up a kind of contribution for the workers as part of it, which is based on the penny in the pound scheme. So they kind of take those corporate ideas and transfer them into this. One question which has been raised is the extent to which contributory schemes crowd out traditional voluntary responses. Well, I would say in Sheffield, clearly it does. You know, 80% of the money raised for the hospitals by the end of the 30s is coming from the penny in the pound scheme. But that's not surprising if employers are contributing £50,000 through their employer's arm. You know, the middle classes are giving their money, but they're giving it through this structure rather than being asked to contribute every minute of the day by someone with a tin. I think also there's an importance of local social, economic and political cultures in this. The strength of the trade unions, the kind of corporatist ideas that operate in large-scale organisations like Camel Laird, allow this system to be set up and to work very easily. I mean, it's very, very effectively run organisationally. There are problems around who is entitled to it, and you get these issues arising towards the end of the 30s around groups like school teachers and policemen who are seen as being too wealthy to be in the scheme. But generally speaking, it works very effectively. In Leeds, on the other hand, I would say that there's a diverse but mixed portfolio, which you might almost see as more of the same, more of what they had before. And the backbone of this, 40% roughly of contributions come from an independent contributory scheme, the Leeds Work People's Hospital Fund. It's a flat rate contributory scheme, which means they give tuppence or then goes up to threepence, but it isn't linked to wage inflation. And it allocates, it makes the decisions about how much money it's going to allocate to different institutions. So that's its choice, and it makes decisions on how it's going to spend its money. On the other hand, you see a continuation of diverse traditional sources. Donations actually go up in cash terms in Leeds between the wars. And in donations and subscriptions, the proportion that is raised in that area actually goes up to the late 1920s. Then starts to tail off. But in cash terms, it holds up throughout the interwar period. What Sheffield is, what Leeds is good at, is using its maintenance department to extract payment. Now, this sounds terribly naughty. So it sounds like, you know, the misuse of the almoner and things like that. Actually, they stop using the almoner because the almoner is too ineffective. And instead, they just use a straightforward administrative system through the maintenance department, and it targets outside schemes. So contributory schemes in other towns are targeted to make sure they pay for their members who are treated in the hospital. So it's not done on reciprocal agreements, it's done straightforwardly from charging alternative schemes. And they raise a significant proportion, £15,000 is coming from that source by the end of, so that's about 10% of their income from that source by the end of the period. And they are also developing private patient scheme provision. You see this first of all in the Hospital for Women, and then at the Leeds General Infirmary, and that was that big thing that looked like a battleship, a cruise liner at the end. That's a private wing. And it meets the needs of women who are usually excluded from various different types of schemes, and it meets the needs of the middle classes who are increasingly beginning to whinge that they pay for this, but they can't use it. Now, they're the ones who stump up the money for the best hospital care, but they're actually excluded from it by the rules. So private patient, private provision begins to come in here. And it's actually paid for largely by a very successful campaign for the new wing, in which they do manage to raise £250,000 through old-style tin rattling, which is very, very effective in the mid-30s. You wouldn't expect this kind of level of contribution to be possible, but they do get it, and they get it entirely from traditional methods. Including my favourite thing, which is a penny card thing, where you can pay a penny a week, you get your card stamped, and on the card either is a big picture of a dragon, and you get to stamp out disease by stamping out the dragon as you go along, or you can get a small one if you're better off for sixpences, which each sixpence kills a dragon on its own. So these kinds of schemes are still very active in the 1930s and very successfully done. So contributory schemes alone were not the only route to success, and traditional sources could be mobilised very effectively, particularly still for capital projects in a more traditional setting. And Nick found much the same for Nottingham and Leicester. Briefly, just on the local state, what I would say about them is that they have a complex set of situations where they have to deal with. Some of their patients, they are obliged by law to extract payment from. Some of their patients, they treat for free infectious disease, with the exception of Eastbourne, which actually charged. Can you imagine that? You get take a carted off for infectious disease treatment and then get charged for it at the end. Eastbourne did do that, but most other places don't do it. But this then sets up a dichotomy. If you have something like pneumonia, you can go into an infectious disease hospital with pneumonia and get treated for free. But if you go into the municipal hospital, you have to pay. So the person with the same disease may end up having to pay in one place and not in another. Also through getting admitted through the relieving officer, which means you personally don't have to pay, but somebody does. And one of the interesting things that I've found from Leeds and Sheffield is that the advocates of the municipal system often say, well, we have the whole weight of the ratepayer behind us, so we can do big capital projects. But actually, the two capital projects which are launched in Leeds and Sheffield are both held up persistently throughout the 20s, 30s, because councils have alternative priorities. And they don't want to spend money on hospitals, actually. They want to spend it particularly on housing. And another problem which local authorities have is that they are limited physically to treating patients only from within their own boundaries, and they're still related, limited to some extent socially to patients who are of lower social class, although that's not entirely the case, particularly not maternity cases, where there are quite a lot of women opt to have their babies in hospitals. Briefly on speciality and locality or specialism, I have an American spell checker on my iMac and it won't let me use certain words, so it's come up with a strange spelling of specialty. Development of specialist services. Yeah, I mean, in the 19th century, you see kind of everywhere develops the same sets of services. ENT, skin, eyes, chest, infectious diseases. Maternity provision is limited in a lot of places, and obstetrics, but it begins to take off around the First World War. And in both cities around the First World War, about 10% of women have their babies in hospitals. They're mostly there because they're going to have difficult births, or they're of certain social background, or certain social groups. But what happens across the two cities is that in Leeds, there is a huge campaign backed by the voluntary and the state sector to provide provision for women to have their babies in hospitals. The result of which is, by 1940, half of all babies in Leeds are born in hospital, which is, the, I think, it's the highest after London in terms of the proportion. In Sheffield, on the other hand, it's about 25%, which is average, and services in Sheffield are predominantly still, they're not very well coordinated, and they're split across voluntary and municipal sector, and they're not very well organised. And one of the key features, I think, which organises the Leeds provision is the Leeds Babies Welcome, which is a voluntary organisation that runs antenatal clinics. And this is the kind of conduit through which women are assessed and sent into hospitals. And so there's interesting mixes, not just between the two hospital sectors, but also using this other voluntary organisation to actually process and bring women into kind of connection with the medical services. Sheffield, on the other hand, just has one central centre. And I attribute a lot of this to the local needs again, which is the power of women in the workforce and the power of the women in local politics in Leeds, in contrast to Sheffield. On the other hand, orthopaedics in Sheffield is a rapidly developing area. Leeds becomes famous for it after the war, but between the wars it's Sheffield, and it's largely attributable here to accidents in the workplace and to support which comes from employers and increasingly through the miners' welfare to developing services in this area. And I would just say, I think on cancer, because it's had a bit of a bad press between the wars, that in fact both of these cities are developing rapidly cancer services which mix voluntary and municipal provision. Voluntary for the acute treatment and municipal for the chronic kind of care of patients. And that they are beginning to spread onto a regional basis to the extent that Leeds actually opens a centre in Hull in 1945, and much of this is happening before the Cancer Act comes in. In fact, in some respects, the Cancer Act confuses what Leeds and Sheffield are doing by taking the focus away from hospital provision and putting it into a more generalised service. So you do see some area, regional specialism in general is developing in a number of areas within the voluntary hospitals, but that does cause some tensions, which we'll see briefly in a moment. So just on cooperation and coordination, I mentioned it there through cancer treatment, radium treatment. Sheffield is often held up as one of the bright sparks of coordination between the wars. And in fact, it's sort of described as a good example of what you're supposed to be doing with the 1929 Act when it's surveyed in 1933. It sets up committees in 1929 to coordinate voluntary and municipal action. As a result of meetings held in 1930, there's an agreement to service allocation, particularly in maternity care and accidents. There is an agreement to transfer some waiting list patients from the voluntary hospital into the municipal hospital. It possibly reflects the voluntary sector's weakness at this point, financially, that they aren't actually in a strong bargaining position, and they agree to a lot of things with the council, which they subsequently may regret. And I think a lot of Sheffield's good publicity is to do with the fact that it submits a very, very good case to the Sankey Commission. I've seen what they send in. And it's great, you know, it says Sheffield is absolutely fantastic. It's brilliant. You should all do what we do in Sheffield. And that's in 1935, but I shall come back in a minute to why I think that's why I was being slightly sarcastic there. Leeds, on the other hand, is invisible. Nobody ever mentions Leeds as a place in which there is any kind of cooperation. And there's certainly a political rhetoric in the city which is anti-competitive. There's very strong political rhetoric against the voluntary sector from the Labour Party, for example. Yet what we find through the Ministry of Health surveys is extensive hospital-based cooperation in which the doctors are cooperating with each other on the transfer of patients in quite a sophisticated way, ad hoc but sophisticated. And the Medical Officer of Health inspector says I can't find it here. A good example of the achievement of a very satisfactory cooperation without formal consultation. So this is one of these cases where you actually, if you dig down, you can see that it's working. And it does, it's not a committee that makes things work, it's actually what's happening on the ground. But I made the point at the beginning that things are not linear. And interestingly, what happens in Sheffield is that the system begins to fall apart just after they give that evidence to Sankey. There is then a crisis in Sheffield. The voluntary hospitals, as I mentioned, set out to build a new hospital, and they do it without consulting the local authority. And the local authority get very knocked about this, and they stop taking their patients, they withdraw their financial support, which they've been giving to waiting list patients, and they move into a political attack on the voluntary sector, and in particular on the fact that the voluntary sector has been using the spare beds, which the scheme has delivered, to take more patients from outside Sheffield. So they're using Sheffield ratepayers' money, but they're not benefiting Sheffield patients. And it leads to a crisis to the extent that when the surveyors go in 1945, they find Sheffield is actually a very poor example of cooperation by that point. Leeds, on the other hand, continues to converge. They set up a committee in 1936. They include the West Riding of Yorkshire into it in 1937. So it's effectively a county-wide regional scheme that they're developing. They're developing cancer, children's services, orthopaedic services are all being discussed in this. And in 1939, they actually make a joint appointment of a neurosurgeon between the voluntary and the municipal sectors. So who's for and against? Cooperation is kind of facilitated by a group of different people. It's not just the Medical Officer of Health. It is politicians at the local council level. They can be quite vociferous opponents, like George Martin appears to be. But at another level, George Martin, who is the chair of the Health Committee in Leeds, is also chairman of the Leeds Public Dispensary. So he's actually involved in both organisations. He's on both sides of the fence. And he makes decisions which reflect his kind of dual status. So when there is an attempt to corral all maternity services into one voluntary hospital, he opposes that as the chair of the Health Committee because he doesn't want that. So he's not always an compromising supporter of the voluntary sector. Doctors, I think, are very, very important and massively underrated in this. When I look around, you know, you see the quote from Rivett saying the EMS is the first time in which doctors find themselves in municipal hospitals. It's a parody of what he says. But there is that kind of general impression that doctors don't move about. Yet, in both these cities, there are significant numbers, particularly significant numbers of voluntary hospital visiting consultants in the municipal sector. In some cases, they even have allocated beds. In the case of cancer, they have a joint appointment of the neurosurgeon. You've got sort of clear doctors facilitating this strong interaction between the two sectors, which is very much against the kind of image which we have, which is largely promoted by a London-centred view, I think. Universities, where they exist, and they do in both these cities, are also important. They're interested, they are self-interested in getting their students the best education. And they tend, and I think there's some evidence of this in Bristol as well, to kind of try and push these hospitals to work together so that the doctors can, so that training can be best done. And finance obviously sharpens the minds of all. Cooperation on quite a lot of the drive to cooperation in both of these cities comes from the contributory schemes. Because the contributors don't want choice, they want treatment. You know, they don't care, often. That's an exaggeration, they do care, but you know, their primary priority is to get treated. And so they push, they said, we've paid for this, we expect to get treatment. And so they push the two sectors to work together to ensure that contributors get treated. And you see that, for example, can't remember which one of them it is, but this, the figures are very similar anyway. Virtually the same number of contributors are being treated in voluntary hospitals as are being treated in municipal hospitals by the end of the 1930s. So they're basically paying for people to get treated across both sectors. They don't care, particularly by this point, who does it. On the other hand, cooperation can be weakened by regulations. I point out this problem that councils face, that they can't treat patients from outside except by, under very strict agreements which involve transfer of cash. This is not a problem that faces the voluntary hospitals. So it's quite difficult to create a regional system when one set part of that regional system can't play to the same rules as the other. Leeds is better placed because the West Riding of Yorkshire can work with them. Sheffield is quite badly placed geographically because it's on the border of four separate counties. And so it's going to have to deal with four separate counties to get by. I don't have a conclusion. I don't know what happened here. I just decided, yeah, whatever, as my sister, as my daughter was suggesting last night, sort of some hospitals are better than others, aren't they? No, that's not really the answer, is it? I have got it written down there. I think there's been an overly pessimistic view of interwar hospital services, as you will have gathered from my presentation. I think it's... Now, the... Obviously, we're looking at two highly developed, sophisticated centres here, but that's what they are. They are centres of hospital services. They are already providing a regional-based service. And so, because Doncaster doesn't have something, it doesn't mean to say people in Doncaster are not being treated. They're probably being treated in Leicester, in Leeds, for their specialist needs. It's based on partially the interwar. The history is largely based on patchy and partial sources. I think that the universalist critique of the services is ahistorical, and I noticed that John Pixton makes some very helpful comments on this, which I haven't written down, but I think that he does sort of pick this up about using sort of the politics of a lot of these ways in which we see the pre-NHS system. And so some of the universalist critiques verge on the ahistorical, and they're unhelpful for understanding how and why services were shaped as they were. there's also rapid and effective change occurring. This is a 20-year period that we're looking at, which starts with, you know, the massive disruption of the First World War, and yet by the late 1930s it's clear, looking at both of these two cities, that both of these cities are now becoming quite prosperous again, and they're generating significant momentum towards closer development and much higher specialisation. And that's why locality is really important in shaping the services which we see. You know, Leeds has strong services for women because women in Leeds are a much more prominent part of the social makeup of the city, I would argue. In Sheffield, a system which ensures that men are treated and returned to work quickly is important, and employers are therefore willing to sign up to what turns out to be a very expensive scheme for them. And I think so, therefore, the cities who put the light has obviously decided it's had enough.
We're all wrapped.
Yes. Yes, the men that cities were developing or trying to develop the hospital services they wanted and needed. So, on that bombshell, I shall end.